And so I know, if anybody would like to know anything about the genealogy stuff,
I do know that she went to Merlin and he told her like entire genealogy. I didn't understand.
I got the basic concept of kind of like, okay, here's kind of what's going on. But
well, if we'd read our version, it would have been cut.
Well, I had, were you being cut out of it?
Yeah. The genealogy part.
Well,
that's
I didn't understand that part. So,
it was cut.
Yeah.
Like it was cut. Like you would have been able to use those hours productively.
Hit right here and just kind of bounce right off. So I was like, oh.
It's like the Begats in Exodus, or the royal lineage in which book of the Iliad? How many have read the Iliad here? Yeah. Did you all, do you remember book, was it 2, where they talk, what?
I said, I'm kidding, I didn't read it.
Are you kidding?
I was kidding.
So you've read it. Sorry, somebody down here said
that
they read
it.
Do you remember? Do you remember that endless passage? That endless passage of the lineages of the kings that came along with Agamemnon to Troy. You know, that was this poem's homage. That's why the version I gave you cut it. I also did not have you read Canto 2, which. It was an important canto, so I thought I'd just go over briefly Canto 2 and before we get to Canto 3.
Was the thing with the mirror explaining Canto 2?
It was. Like and so was that confusing without
the... Just in general, like, getting into it.
It kind of made sense, I think.
Yeah.
I think I got the basic idea, but... Probably knowing what
I should have made you all read it. Matt Shelton got to read it, and he's richer for it. And I just was trying to pare away some of the time, the length that it would take you to read it. So I did cut chapter 2. I'm afraid that's a mistake. Go to Canto 2 in your copy, if you will, please. Now that everybody's here, I want to have your attention, particularly of the newcomers, and exhort you to come on time to class. I know some of you have a long ways to go, but it's getting to be, you know, really late into the class. So try your best, okay? So that we can not lose so much of our time of waiting for people to assemble. Book 2 tells how Britomart, she bumps into the Red Cross Knight, and she tells the story she asks Red Cross Knight where Arthagal is. And Arthagal says, you know, and she says, why, Red Cross Knight says, why do you want to know where Arthagal is? And she says, oh, he really wronged me. He did me this terrible sin, you know, and I'm out for vengeance. Red Cross said, how could this be? He's the most wonderful knight that ever lived. And Britomart keeps goading him on, saying, nah, he's a foul villain, in order to elicit his praise. And then inside, she's just warming and getting excited at all this praise of her lover. And then there's a long flashback about how she fell in love with Arthagal. And it turns out, I wanted to say one thing about this tricking Red Cross by pretending not to like the man she's deeply in love. You know, of course, we've mentioned before that notions of chivalry trump truth in this culture. A little something additional is going on here. Britomart there is reproducing an episode from the Odyssey. Where Odysseus tricks a couple of different people. First, he tricks Achilles into coming by telling him this story, and then he coming to Troy, and then he tricks the guy with the bow. I'll think of his name in a second. What? Paris is a good bowman, good memory, but no, this is a guy on the Greek side. At any rate, do you recall Odysseus' name as a hero, his nickname, his his epithet. It's not his name, his quality. You know, it's always the blank Odysseus. Do you recall what his trait is?
Gray-eyed
Athena, right? Gray-eyed Athena, the Minerva.
Crafty Odysseus,
wily Odysseus, cunning Odysseus. Wily, you got it? Okay, you know, what depends on your English translation. I go with wily. In our household, everybody talks about wily Odysseus. She's wily. It doesn't seem that wily, but nonetheless, that's the little extra thing, that lying is not a problem, and being wily is a virtue for Britomart. So I wanted to mention that as we continue characterizing Britomart, and then let's go to, say, Canto 17, stanza 17, Canto 2. You all there? Oh, you're not numbered, are you? Okay, do it. Can you do a search? Mm-hmm. Let's say Sith, S-I-T-H. How many Sith do you have in this one?
Sith.
What?
Sith.
Sith him, Wilhelm? Nope, that didn't do it, okay.
Sith him well on.
Sith him well on. Yeah.
Okay, you got that? Everybody found it in their copy? It's line 145, stanza 17. Well, this is where she falls in love with Arthagal, and I'll read it to you. Yet him in every part... she just said, you know, describe him to me, just so she could hear how manly and studly he is. And then it says, yet, even before... he'd been described to her, him in every part before she knew, however lister now her knowledge fain, sith him whilome in Britain she did view, to her revealed in a mirror plain, whereof did grow her first in grafted pain, whose root and stalk so bitter yet did taste, that but the fruit more sweetness did contain, her wretched days in dolor she might waste, and yield the prey of love to loathsome death at last. By strange occasion she did him behold, and much more strangely gan to love his sight, as it in books hath written been of old, in Deheubarth, that now South Wales is hight called, what time King Rayance reigned in Deeled right, the great magician Merlin had devised by his deep science and well-dreaded might a looking-glass, right wondrously aguised, whose virtues through the wide world soon were solemnized. It virtue had to show in perfect sight whatever thing was in the world contained, betwixt the lowest earth and heaven's height, so that it to the looker appertained. Whatever foe had wrought or friend had feigned, therein discovered was, nay aught might pass, nay aught in secret from the same remained, for thy it round and hollow shaped was, like to the world itself, and seemed a world of glass.
So, it's like a crystal ball.
It's a crystal ball. They call it a mirror everywhere but right there in one other place, but it's a crystal ball, and it's a palantir. And I really wanted you to get that notion, because you know, there's a lot that Tolkien has taken from here, and that Merlin and his palantir, his crystal ball, his far-seeing globe, is what she's looked in. And her father, Rayance, has it in his closet, and she sneaks in, much like a foolish hobbit, except here she's not foolish to do so. And in it she sees her future love, Arthagal, who is compared to Achilles, is the best fighter in all the world. He lives in fairyland, but he's not an elf. He just lives in fairyland. Fairyland, as we'll discuss when we start working on our game, is not the same as Britain. It sort of is and isn't Britain, because Britomart is a Briton. Arthogal. Oh, he's a Briton too. But elves live in Fairyland, and he's in Fairyland right now, and so that's why she's gone off looking for him. And she's taken as her squire a Glaus, or Glauce, G-L-A-U-C-E, Glauce, Glauce, Glauch. You could probably see how to spell it if he rhymed it anywhere. I can't resist reading you stanza 40 and 41. Go to one that says daughter. That's the first word, daughter. Did it come up in a search?
Is this a canto
2 or 3? Still canto 2. Daughter, said she.
It's like 3 or 4.
That's a Yoda-ism.
What?
That's a Yoda-ism.
Is it?
Daughter, said she.
Okay. She's been talking about how horrible it is for her, a chaste maiden, to be in love with a man she's never met. And Glaus is reassuring her, and nurse is saying, oh, it's not so bad. And listen to this. Daughter, said she, what need you be dismayed, or why make you such monster of your mind? Of much more uncouth thing I was afraid. She was afraid of filthy lust, contrary unto kind. But this affection, nothing strange I find, for who with reason can you I reprove to love the semblant pleasing most your mind, and yield your heart when she cannot remove? No guilt in you, but in the tyranny of love. So there's no sin in loving the most handsome man she's ever seen. You know, who wouldn't blame you? You know, a hunk of that magnitude? Fine. Well, but she says, you know, don't worry about it. Not so, it's not nearly as bad as these people. Not so the Arabian myrrh did sit her mind, nor so did Byblus spend her pining heart, but loved their native flesh against all kind, and to the purpose used wicked art. That is, not so the daughter who had sex with her father. And not so pacify a more monstrous part that loved a bull and learned a beast to be. Such shameful lust, who loathes not, which depart from course of nature and of modesty? Sweet love, such lewdness bans from his fair company. So Glaus comforts her by saying, at least you're not sleeping with your father or engaging in bestiality.
that's a good extreme to compare.
Yeah, you know, so
you're not doing this, so it's okay.
So it's just fine. And she says, and so even, and but still, Britomart will not get over her pining for heartbreak for love. And so Glaus goes out on an herb quest. How many in this game have gathered herbs?
Many a time.
Many a time. Right here. Glaus searches for this herb and then goes and gets 6 of that herb and goes and gets more of these and makes up potions and gives it to her, and it doesn't cure her. So finally they decide to go find out where he is by asking Merlin. And that's what gets you to Canto 3. So in Canto 3, they're off. And Canto 3, let's turn to Canto 3, and it begins with 2 stanzas praising Cupid. And I want you to pay close attention to Canto 3. I want you to pay close attention to how Cupid and Venus are portrayed throughout this poem. You know, what, and maybe we can, I won't say anything exactly now about that, and maybe we can have a discussion about what Spencer seems to want you to think about Cupid and Venus. But at any rate, talks about Elizabeth, and they go down to Merlin's cave where, what's going on in Merlin's cave in the present?
Like somebody's building a wall.
Yeah, this is where he has like the fairies or whatever, like building a wall even though he's gone.
Because he told them
to keep going and they're scared of him or something. So even though he's gone, they're still building this wall.
That's right. That's right. That's right. It's sort of perpetually working down through eternity on this wall surrounding his cave. But at any rate, this is all a flashback back to how they found it. And, you know, Merlin, why didn't Merlin return?
He went to the Lady of the Lake and was detained there.
In a prison there. Now, I thought he was imprisoned by Nimue. But maybe the Lady of the Lake.
Some people equate Nimue with the Lady of the Lake.
Aha, thank you. Which is a typical romance thing to do. Some versions, you know, character is just a version of another character, and very, very, very typical. Good. So Merlin down in his cave with the laboring dwarfs or trolls or orcs or something reminds me of Saruman, the wizard, and the declivity or underground mines that he creates there. That may be enough on book three. Merlin tells him that of the union of Arthagul and Britomart, what's going to come?
Thus the kings of Brit.
Right. Yeah. So the part you didn't have to read goes on and details, you know, this mythical history of the lineage of the kings of Britain right down to its culmination in who?
Elizabeth,
which is right out of what poet? Virgil. I'll answer my own question since I don't think anybody was about to shout that name out. It was you were right there. Who tells the lineage of Rome from the Trojans right down to Augustus Caesar, who was his patron. What? You were going to say Augustus? Perfect. Okay. And if you go to stanza 22, you'll even see another motif that links Arthagul, Britomart's, the story of Arthagul and Britomart's progeny and ultimately of Elizabeth back to Virgil and from Virgil back to Troy. Stanza 22, for so must all things excellent begin. Everybody there?
It's Canto 3, right?
Still in Canto 3, that's right. For so must all things excellent begin, and eke and rooted deep must be that tree, meaning family tree. That's right, perfect. Whose big embodied branches shall not lean till they to heaven's height forth stretched be. For from thy womb a famous progeny shall spring out of the ancient Trojan blood, which shall revive the sleeping memory of those same antique pairs, that is, parents, the heaven's brood, which Greek and Asian rivers stained with their blood. So what has he done there?
Made an illusion.
He definitely has made an illusion. It's
called foreshadowing. Foreshadowing the birth of someone in the future.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely that, too. But he's made Elizabeth the lineal descendant of Aeneas, the only survivor of the fall of Troy. So what you've got here is a kind of westering of greatness, a moving westward from Greece or from Asia Minor to Rome, which Virgil did. And then Spenser goes, yeah. And from Rome to England and Queen Elizabeth. And so all that, you see how even though this is a romance, not an epic, she is using epic techniques to tie it to the fate of nations and the fate of empire. And Elizabeth, in fact, did create a pretty big empire. She was the, you know, the defeat of the Spanish Armada was the moment that people began to see the shift. You know, a shift from Spain to England in terms of imperial power. So he is making a political allegory there. What else is he doing? What other additional benefit comes from the westering of greatness from Asia Minor to, really, actually, from Asia Minor to Greece, from Greece to Rome, from Rome to Spain, from Spain to England? What other collateral benefit for Spenser the poet? Poetry as well. That's another subtext. So it's a political allegory, but it's also a kind of allegory of poetry, so that he's laying claim to the mantle of great poetry, taking it over from Homer, Virgil, Dante, now me. So in those of you that had your edition, had a summary of books of the rest of the stanzas and of Canto 4 and Canto 5, or most of Canto 5, and then picked up at stanza 27 of Canto 5, where you learn the story of Belphoebe and Timaeus. Now, we're going to devote most of this class to talking about Canto 6. Canto 6 is probably the most famous canto in Faery Queen. It is at the exact center of the book. Well, the book is 12 cantos, so arguably 6 or 7 could be the center. But it is at the center or the heart of it, and it is certainly at the symbolic heart of Canto 6, of the book. And 3 and 4, books 3 and 4 are the heart of this sixth book poem. So it's the center of the center, one of the two centers of the center. What's the action of Canto 6?
It's like Belphoebe's
That's right. Belphoebe being raised by Diana. Amoret
by Venus.
And then what else? Is that just stretching, or do you have an answer?
Stretching.
What's the other most notable feature?
You said the Venus one.
Mm-hmm.
Getting who?
Can of sex.
Right. It's the other. Venus took one, and then. I forgot which god, but took
Diana took
Belphoebe. Belphoebe and raised her as the symbol chest. Two dwarfs.
Yeah, that's. I mean, what's the most noticeable action in all?
Would be the bird.
The virgin birth of those twins.
Yeah.
Yes.
My son being.
Definitely. Definitely. What else is going on in that stanza? Did everybody have a chance to read it? Did anyone not actually get a chance to read it? Okay, so the most the longest.
Is it the whole poem often? Is it
Belphoebe
being
raised by Diana? What I'm
thinking of is the whole fable of the Garden of Adonis. Now, so we're going to work our way through and talk about that in detail. But before we do, I wanted to just talk about Britomart and all these other women in the book. Let me draw your attention right up there. Book three. I want to spend time on the sort of the symbolic patterns that the characters and the places in this poem make. So Britomart is clearly at the center of the poem. And she is our heroine that runs all the way through the whole book. But all around her, you get intertwined these endless pairs of lovers. And one of which would be Florimel. Florimel is the most beautiful of all the women in the poem. And she is, I would say, stands for vulnerable chastity. How do we first see her?
Being chased
by somebody trying to rape her. So it's the vulnerability of great beauty that is being incarnated in Florimel. Another who we meet in this book, and it is Belphoebe, who is a kind of type of immature, innocent chastity. She doesn't know anything of the world. She's absolutely pure, because where has she lived?
Naive.
She's definitely naive. Where has she lived?
With
the nymphs in the forest, been taken care of by Diana. What's Diana's epithet? What's she known for? Athena is gray-eyed and wise. What is she?
Goddess of the wood.
Goddess of the hunt and of the woods, yes, definitely.
Like she's graceful or something.
She is definitely graceful. But chaste because she has nothing to do with men. She forswears them. It's not, Formel's got no problem with men, but she's really vulnerable. Belphoebe, raised by chaste Diana is an Amazon-like figure who doesn't like men, never wants to be even seen by men. What happens to the one guy that does sneak out into the woods and look at Diana and her nymphs when they're naked?
Gets turned into a stag, gets killed by his own dogs.
Yeah, that would be Actaeon, killed by his own was a hunter. He gets turned into his stags, and his own dogs drag him. Tear him limb from limb. And Marinelle, you don't get to read about particularly, but he's in there, and he's male, but he is a kind of timid or cowardly lover. He's fearful. His chastity comes because he's too shy. Maybe I should have said shy chastity. So it's a different way to be chaste, is that you're just too shy for it. And Amoret is faithful chastity. And Amoret and Belphoebe are, of course, twins. Now, Britomart unites all of these qualities. She clearly, tell me why she's not each of these.
She's not vulnerable.
She certainly isn't vulnerable.
She takes care of herself.
She's not no fear.
Right. No fear.
She is faithful.
Yeah, she is faithful. She's not innocent, not immature. She is faithful. So much for my diagram. Is she faithful? Is she 100% faithful?
Is she unfaithful? She's faithful to her beliefs, her psyche. She's faithful to what she loves.
She is pretty faithful. Max, you're being quiet today.
Associating the word faithful to like faithful to a man, I guess. And like chastity kind of like faithful, chastity. I don't think I understand it fully enough to know that she's not.
Do you mean by faithful chastity that she's being faithful to a certain person by not going out and doing stuff, or being faithful in her chastity by not doing that at all, not wanting it?
That's
what's kind of confusing for me.
Yeah. Maybe I need to come up with a better word. I made this up right after lunch. You know, Belphoebe is more the, and Diana is more the celibate type. It's that Britomart is out there in the world. You know, she's not afraid of being sullied. She is wounded in the first book, and as you will discover in the first canto, and in the 12th canto, she's wounded again. She is. I mean, another way to put it is maybe she's a little bit of each of these, but not, she's got the positive and the negatives of each of these. Because she is a vulnerable to this world. It's not like she's remote or removed. Her faithfulness doesn't keep her from engaging. You know, she's out there questing away. And that's Amoret is Amoret, like her sister Belphoebe, is pretty innocent. Let me go to the next slide. Now, the opposite of these folks are Malacastra and Bucerain that you'll meet in Canto 12. So the book begins and ends with the very opposite. And Bucerain is male, Malacastra is female. Where do Malacastra's scenes take place? Where? Castle Joyous. And Bucerain's take place in Castle Bucerain. So that you see that the book is structured with the indoor scenes at the beginning and the end, both of which are corrupt indoor spaces. And where does the rest of the book take place?
Outdoors.
Down the plains, the woods.
The fact that the indoor scenes are the corrupt ones, that's supposed to mean that society is corrupt if you do that, and that's where we live in, whereas everything away from society, even nature and natural scenes are better.
But you know.
But even they're not pure.
There's that just coincidence.
Well, it definitely wasn't Spence's intention.
Yeah, it was not.
I think that in book three, that's the symbolic geography. Other books, it's different.
But even. Nature is not pure because of the huntsman.
Because of what?
Like the huntsman.
The huntsman, and believe me, in the books that you missed, they have giants raping heroines, and they have, I'll tell you about some of them just in a second. Some other of these antitypes. There is a lot of foul stuff going on outdoors, but in this book, I think you're absolutely right, Amir, that the symbolic geography is that these castles are corrupt areas, and this questing out in the wilderness, in the plains, and in the woods is where you at least have the freedom to run away or to fight for your honor, etc. But, you know, in book one, Red Cross Knight is journeying toward the city of Jerusalem, the heavenly city of Jerusalem, and the city was put forward as the goal of all good men and women. So, you know, Spencer is able to adjust that symbolic geography for different purposes. Other antitypes that you don't meet, but in I believe sort of book. Or maybe Braggadocio, who's male, but his love, I forget her name, he's the first person that tries to despoil Florimel. Everybody's after Florimel. And she's vulnerable in a big way, and she's chased all through this poem. Braggadocio. But
the word is brag.
Well observed. Yes. Well observed.
Can't get anything past you.
And Eleanor, Eleanor, who's married, first has Paradel comes. The Paradel comes to her her castle, where she's living there with her husband, and with Red Cross and Arthur. And first Paradel seduces her, and then they run away to the wilderness where Paradel dumps her, but she doesn't mind because she's next observed by Britomart having an orgy with 9 satyrs. So, you know, maybe bestiality is an option that Gossi was had reason to worry about. But as you see, you get plenty of symbolic antitypes to Britomart. And then, on the kind of heavenly level, you get Venus. Venus, I would, as you will see in Book 12, and we're going to have our full discussion of Venus and Cupid in Book in Adonis after we've read Book 12. But Venus is maybe the center of this entire poem. You know, Britomart certainly is the heroine, but Venus is symbolically at least the equal of Britomart in terms of importance in the poem. And where does she dwell? You now know the answer to this. Garden of Adonis. She dwells in the Garden of Adonis, which we'll discuss shortly. And she's flanked in her mural, in these various tapestries and ekphrastic passages, by Adonis on the one side. What does Thanatos mean? Is that a term you've heard?
Death.
It's a Greek word for death. And Cupid, Eros. And death and desire have often been linked in poetry, certainly, in the French language world, a little death. And I would say that Venus's sister, Diana, is her antitype, you know, total renunciation and chase. So, with that in mind, let's go over Book 6 the way we did last class period with, Canto 6. Go to Canto 6 in your poem. It says that this is going to be about the birth of Fair Belphoebe and of Amoret is told. The Garden of Adonis is fraught with pleasures manifold. That's just a little head note to chapter, to Canto 6. go to the fifth stanza. We'll start there. It were a goodly story to declare by what strange accident fair Chrysogony conceived these infants, and how them she bare in this wild forest wandering all alone after she had 9 months fulfilled and gone. For not as other women's commune brood, they were enwombed in the sacred throne of her chaste body, nor with commune food as other women's babes they sucked vital blood. but wondrously they were begot and bred through influence of the heaven's fruitful ray, as it in antique books is mentioned. It was upon a summer's shiny day when Titan fair his beams did display in a fresh fountain far from all men's view. She bathed her breast and the boiling heat to allay. She bathed with roses red and violets blue and all the sweetest flowers that in the forest grew. Till faint through irksome weariness, down upon the grassy ground herself she laid to sleep, the whiles a gentle slumbering swoon upon her fell, all naked, bare displayed. The sunbeams bright upon her body played, being through former bathing mollified, and pierced into her womb, where they embayed, with so sweet sense and secret power unspied, that in her pregnant flesh they shortly fructified. So, what just happened in those four stanzas, or three stanzas?
Immaculate Conception.
Yes, Immaculate Conception. What motif is that picking up on?
Jesus.
Yeah. So,
Jesus.
What?
No, sorry.
She's being compared to the virgin birth of Jesus Christ. Is this a blasphemous poem? What?
Sure, it's been called that before. I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't think so.
Why not, Chris?
It contains like biblical themes. Yeah. I think it's more like protesting against Catholic Church. Maybe supporting protesting.
Excellent. Why is it protesting against the Catholic Church and supporting the Protestant Church? English Church is a Protestant Church, and Spencer wrote it for a Protestant Queen Elizabeth who's fighting against the Catholics. Yes. So Chris is really on to something. And did the Protestants then believe in the virgin birth?
No.
If they did, it wasn't an important part of their theology. It was very much Catholic. Catholic-centric belief. So there's that. Why else is this not blasphemous? Help me out, folks.
Thinking.
What?
I'm thinking.
Okay.
It's more like Greek theology.
It is like Greek theology. It's very definitely like Greek. In fact, it's like a specific myth in Greece. How does she get pregnant? How does this virgin birth occur?
Like the Zeus light thing.
Yep, the Zeus light thing. Exactly. Let's just go to old Google Images and see what we get for Titian's famous painting, A Shower of Gold, where there Zeus clothed in the shape of sunbeams comes zooping straight down into her loins, impregnating the poor lady. And also, the myth says that they're light beams that as they hit turn into gold coins, so that she's collecting gold coins in her lap while being impregnated. That's the Greek myth. So, you know, Zeus was up to stuff like this all the time. Who else did he trick in this way? And give me some of the shapes he assumed. What?
So did he pay her?
He didn't have to. He was Zeus, man. What, Derek?
Godly prostitution.
Yeah.
There's a bull.
Yeah. Who got raped by the white bull?
I want to say Io.
Io's the name of the bull, well called. Europa.
Europa.
Yeah, giving us all of Europe.
There's a painting called Laodicean.
Laodicean?
Laodicean. So, like, it's Zeus takes the form of a swan.
Leda. Leda and the swan?
Yeah. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes, let's see if we get a few Lita in the song. Oh, that's a pretty erotic one. I've seen that in person.
Google search
is incredible. Blind. So there's Zeus, and it makes clear, I think
what's
that,
going on?
It makes clear that it's rape. You know, Zeus was quite the predator. There's Lita in the recumbent position. Well, there's Zeus in the swan position. Let's get us a quick image of Io in Europa. Not that Europa.
Not the moons of Jupiter. Where?
I'm going to Titian. Titian's big on these things. Give us there, the rape of Europa. Thank you. That one looks better. There she is being borne off by Io. There's her maiden saying, "Whoa, come back. You should never have dallied with that white bull."
I read that story in Latin.
You did read it in Latin? In whose version?
It was part of my whole
Ovid's version?
I guess. It was just like, we get the sheets of stories that we have translated.
So it's invoking there all these Greek myths, but particularly Danae and the shower of gold, with the beam of light impregnating. And, you know, in each and every one of them, the woman didn't want it, but the fruit of her loins led to great lineages of kings and heroes and stuff. And so, he's invoking all that, but he's analogizing it to the virgin birth. And let's take a quick look at, let's say, paintings of the Annunciation with Christian imagery. Let's see here. Is that going to be a good one? Yeah, this one I've seen. This is gorgeous.
The one in the chapel.
No, darn it. So there's the angel, what is it, Gabriel? Is it Michael or Gabriel that comes to tell her, Virgin Mary, that she's going to, conceive?
She was supposed to have her hand up like this in the Annunciation papers.
There is iconography. The term he's looking for is iconography. And she's usually kneeling at a prie-dieu, that is a prayer stand, usually with a book, a holy book in her hand. So she's interrupted in her studies, her religious or devotional studies, by an angel of the Lord saying, "You're getting ready to be impregnated without sleeping with a man." And where is it coming from? Can you see it in this? Oh, this is it. Tough one to see. Let's see if we can get better light on it. I can see it on mine, darn it.
What are we looking for?
Something you can't see on that picture. Let's see if you can see it on this one. You can really see it on my screen.
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
If you click, you zoom in, Jay.
Thank you. No, well, it's a little...
It's a Christ?
What?
Christ.
It's a little baby Christ bearing on his shoulder a cross, zooming on power rays of the sun, laser beam headed right for the loin. The Renaissance painters were doing the same thing. Of conflating, in Italy, conflating the Immaculate Conception with the rape of Danae. That is, the sunbeams being what impregnates them. And, the second or the third one I clicked on where I found the sunbeams going zoom. You know, there's 100 of these paintings with the sunbeam, with in this case, little infant Christ what's the Renaissance theory of how impregnation occurs that is being invoked right there? How did the Renaissance scientists believe impregnation occurred?
What is it like spontaneous generation?
Well, glad you mentioned spontaneous generation, because that is in the Spencer scene. So clearly Spencer had that in mind, but it's not what is the mainstream scientific explanation. The man imparted what in the act of sexual congress?
Is that the one with the little dude?
The little dude called, I love that, the homunculus. Homunculus. The man had in his testes homunculi, little complete human beings, which he planted in the garden or the fertile soil of the female. This basically sexist paradigm gave all the impregnating power to the male, and the woman was what we might call a fetal container, or a mere fertile ground for the planting. There was a kind of philosophical paradox that they had to wrestle with. So that this theory of how impregnation occurred began to break down in the late Renaissance, when a famous scientist gave a rival theory of impregnation, and he did it while writing a critical essay on Spencer's The Faerie Queen. And he said, you know, this homunculus theory just doesn't make any sense. What really must happen is there must be half of the material must come from the father and half must come from the mother. There must be an egg and a fertilizing agent. And he came up with the entire, he founded the field of embryology. So that was the overturning of that idea. What was the philosophical problem? This is a digression from our poem here with the homunculus theory. The reason I want to draw attention to it, the philosophical problem, is that it's interesting that a theory of how you, a scientific theory, eventually, an explanatory theory, eventually began to break down because it was philosophically so impossible. So if the male, the man contains a little baby man inside it, the little baby man logically must contain a little baby man, and that little baby man must logically contain a little baby man. So Adam must have contained all the little baby men till the end of the world inside of him. And that just seemed a little hard to take as a theory. And eventually people began to look around for a better one. Do you have a question down there? No? Okay. So back to our Spencer poem. Because all of this digression on Renaissance theories of conceptions, I think, valuable, because the whole poem is about generation. What goes on in the Garden of Adonis? It's where Venus raises Amaret. Definitely. What else goes on in the Garden of Adonis?
Something like everything that has existed or will exist on Earth is kind of there and kind of forming, like growing, and then it goes out.
So it is a kind of growing place. It's a garden. All future souls are there in the Garden of Adonis. It's a nursery, pun intended by Spencer, a nursery of all the future people. So describe the geography of it, of the Garden of Adonis. Okay. Let me give you a...
I think it has like two different gates, maybe.
Yes.
And whenever you're born and you go out of it, out of one gate, and then when you died going through the other gate.
Oh, so it's a kind of cyclical process. It's a cyclical garden, like gardens are. So it's fall and spring imagery there. What are the gates made out of? Do you remember, Lynn?
Mm-hmm. One's iron, one's gold.
Perfect. Yes, yes, indeed. And it's ringed around by walls. So it's a circular, womb-like enclosure that's circled by walls with a gate where the dead souls come back in, where they are held for a while until they're reborn and sent back out into this mortal world. The spontaneous generation that Sam, I believe, mentioned is clearly occurring here, but also is occurring in stanza 8. Miraculous, you know, right after where we were, where poor Chrysonome is lying down on the ground, Chrysogome is lying down on the ground naked after swimming. She gets zapped by golden rays and impregnated. Miraculous may seem to... Have we answered clearly why Spencer doesn't get in trouble for blasphemy, for aligning this Renaissance myth of impregnation with the virgin birth? Partially, we've said it's an anti-Catholic polemic, clearly so. What else? It's a classic humanist move. You're seeing it in this painting right there. It's a classic humanist move of synthesizing Greek with Christian imagery and then saying that the Greek imagery is only allegorical of the Christian truth. So Spencer's saying that the impregnation of Amoret and Belphoebe's mom is an allegory or of the only true virgin conception. So that's always his out, that layering of symbolic meanings of Christian on Greek on many other political are all just types of one another, but the really true one we all know is the Christian one. So that's how he doesn't get any trouble for this very, you know, sexually explicit, potentially. Lee, are you raising your hand with a question? Sexually put explicit, in a more Puritan age, blasphemous kind of thing to write. Miraculous may seem to him that reads so strange and sample of conception. The word means then what it means now. But reason teaches that the fruitful seeds of all things living, through impression of the sunbeams and moist complexion, do life conceive and quickened are by kind. So after Nilus, what's that Nilus? The river Nile. After Nilus' inundation, infinite shapes of creatures men do find and form it in the mud on which the sun has shined. That was a great source of the Renaissance belief in spontaneous generation, is that the Nile, as you well know, would overflood its banks, and then when it would shrink again, you'd go out into the mud, there'd be all this life germinating. So people thought it was just water on mud plus sun equaled life. So he invokes that right there. So somebody's...
Are you implying that's not true?
Oh, I'm agnostic. I enjoy multiple versions of allegorical versions of truth. So Belphoebe's mother flies to the forest for her confinement, meaning her, you know, once she gets pregnant, she goes there because she's ashamed. So she's out there getting ready to give birth. Meanwhile, why does Venus go wandering in the forest? She's not really our forest type. Yes, you're grinning.
Just looking for Cupid. He ran off.
So Cupid ran off, and you get Venus searching for Cupid, which our notes helpfully say was a typical a Renaissance poem. It was based on a Greek poem by Moschus, which was often imitated in the Renaissance. And so you have her going high and low through forest and dale, through cities, looking for it, till finally she comes to Diana's haunt, and Diana says, "Venus, sister, what you doing here in the forest?" And Venus says, "You know, I've lost my Cupid again." They together say, "Okay, we'll go look for him." And you go all the way over to stanza 26. To search the God of Love. You got it? So Diana, to search the God of Love, her nymphs she sent throughout the wandering forest everywhere, and after them herself eke with her went to seek the fugitive, both far and near. So long they sought till they arrived were in that same shady covert, whereas lay fair Chrysogony in slumbery trance well air, who in her sleep, a wondrous thing to say, unawares had borne two babes as fair as springing day. So asleep she conceived and asleep she bore twins. Doesn't often happen that way. Unawares she them conceived, unawares she bore withouten pain that she conceived withouten pleasure. What's that withouten pain she bore reference to?
Childbirth.
Childbirth, of course. When Adam and Eve are kicked out of the Garden of Eden, men have to work for their food, and women have to bear children in pain. So, nay, her need implore. Okay, never mind. So then the twins are separated at birth. Typical romance motif. Twins separated at birth. Belphoebe off with chaste Diana. Amoret off to the Garden of Adonis with Venus. Venus takes Amoret to replace Cupid in the Garden of Venus. And then, so beginning with stanza 29, you get the long myth of the Garden of Eden. And what this is, she brought her to her joyous paradise. Do you see that? It's just a stanza or two down. She brought her to her joyous paradise where she most wons, when she on earth doth dwell, so fair a place as nature can devise. It's the Garden of Adonis. This Garden of Adonis story is Spenser's creation. It doesn't exist previously in myth. It's his idea. He draws on some sources. Did your book tell you where he gets the idea of the cyclical rebirth of souls? Did your notes tell you that?
Do they have India at this point?
What?
Did they have India at this point?
Did they own India?
Yeah.
It's like when they enter back into the garden, they shed all of their matter, and then when they leave again, they
reclose
something else. Yet.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. Very interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. They certainly were trading with India in the Renaissance. I don't know the answer to that question. So is it an Eastern myth? Well, it appears in Plato's Republic. The same place we talked about the cave, the myth of the cave. It appears in Plato's Republic. It was Plato's explanation for where souls came from. Plato had a little myth that he made up. It wasn't official Greek religion. It was just Plato's idea that souls must pre-exist their incarnation in flesh, and after death must go back to a kind of waiting place before being sent back out into the world. So Plato, Hindus, had a myth of reincarnation as well. And Spencer makes his own version of it. The Garden of Adonis is a garden with two gates, with pre-existing souls, and if you, the souls are planted in the earth, and like the Nile, they generate and are reborn in bodies. What did this large garden passage what does it remind you of? And say, Tolkien.
This is unrelated. I just looked it up. The British didn't have complete control of India until 1857. So this is back when they were just trading with them.
Just trading.
Right.
Thank you, Colin. What aspect of Tolkien does the Garden of Adonis remind you of?
It's very beautiful. We get some very beautiful imagery in.
Beautiful imagery. All of lush nature, flowers, trees.
Seems kind of like
in the center of it, there's a hill. On the hill lives Venus, dwells whenever she's on Earth. They don't need water, endless fertility. Is that our five minutes? Ooh, we're in trouble. Better step it up. So, what kind of nature, gorgeous, luxurious, fecund places do you get in Tolkien? Rivendell, certainly. What else?
What? Maybe the final journey of
Lothlorien. What?
Like Frodo sent out where he can return.
Oh, the Shire?
He sent out with Bilbo and Gandalf.
Ah, yeah. I don't know. But possibly. But I don't know as much about that because I don't know that. Does Tolkien write about it in the Silmarillion?
He sure is.
What?
Yeah. The way that Tolkien said it was that. Elves are creatures of this earth and cannot leave Middle-earth until the end of time. And that includes, like, whenever they die. So, whenever they die, there's a land that they go to. And they can be reborn from that land, or they can just stay there until the end of time, whatever. And that's where they sail off to, whenever they sail into the west.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking of Tom Bombadil. This is one of those passages that I told you about, a locus amoenus. Locus, L-O-C-U-S, means place in Latin. Amoenus means the pleasant place. It was garden imagery, or it's almost always in this kind of poetry, meant to evoke that. It's one of those pauses in the action. All of Book 6 is a pause in the action of Britomart looking for her lover, fighting people, you know, chasing, raping, all the continuous action that occurs in every other book. Book 6 is this pause in a garden spot with Venus at the heart of it. And let's go to stanza 46. There want fair Venus often to enjoy. There want W-O-N-T, fair Venus oft to enjoy her dear Adonis. So Venus, right at the center of the garden, It's a circle, like a womb. In it, it's all lush garden. And at the center of it is a mountain, like Bald Hill in the old forest, and Tom Bombadil's house. And on this mountain, which is a pun on the Latin term, what's a mount, mountain?
Mons
Veneris. Mons Veneris. That was the Latin term for the female genitalia. The Mons Veneris is specifically being evoked here. So the Garden of Adonis is kind of womb, female pleasure, symbolic space right there. And there wont fair Venus often to enjoy her dear Adonis joyous company and reap sweet pleasure of the wanton boy. There's no, you know, no beating around the bush. She, you know, that's where she lies down to have sex with Adonis. And skipping down to, let's say, and Cupid down in stanza 49, that's also where Cupid comes to have sex with his Psyche. So this is the center of sexual consummation. It's in the garden of birth and regeneration is also the seat of pleasure, sexual pleasure in this myth of this world with Venus and Adonis, Psyche and Cupid, and stanza 51, we're going to read these last three stanzas and then quit for the day. Hither great Venus brought this infant fair, Amoret, and gave Amoret unto Psyche, with great trust and care committed her. And skipping to 53, the first line of 53, and I'll read these last four lines to show you where I got faithful. But Amoret, to none of them her love did cast. She was uncorrupted by all this pleasuring, save to the noble knight, Sir Scudamore, to whom her loving heart she linked fast in faithful love. So, thank you all for staying about 30 seconds too late. Run, run, run if you've got to be somewhere. For Thursday, the last two cantos, 11 and 12, it's solid action. And
yes.
And not so hot, not nearly so symbolic. Well, some symbolism.
Added the chaste and unchaste faction reviewing some of the scripts.
Did you really? So we now have factions?
Yes, we have factions.
Unbelievable. I wondered what you were so hard at work over there.
Well, when I was listening to you go through it, I was like, now's the time we need
so
to put this
right
in
now
here.
I just want you to give Cheerable infinite chase points.
You're a lech, is what I want to do. I'm going to give Cheerable 100 unchased on the faction rating.
My mom got it in
bronze.
So what are we
going to
do about it?
I don't know, man. You know, I'm just going to sit down and think about that. Let's let the room clear out and we'll strategize. You off to something else right away? Or we'll hang tight a second to think about it. What I've been trying to do is Cindy's laptop won't work either.
You were quiet.
Well, she's got the same problem you do. The Toshiba's have a video gym.
No,
that absolutely crap was
out.
Can you, you're not able to even pull up the editor?
No, I did. I read it.
That
I just had to get up really
yeah,
to do
like
it.
When it pulls it up, it goes into that final screen.
Bring it home with you. Really
it kills it.
No.
It's
a
good question.
No, it's not you. It's the chair. We really need to put it on our website. The Fairy Queen is only at the Central Library.
I put the links out for the University of Oregon has book three.
Right.
And that's what I've been, as you've been following, I've been using the big type old man's version of it. I mean,
is that the one you've been referencing to? But it's it doesn't have notes.
It doesn't have numbers. So what I have to do is when you say a phrase,
right.
I've been doing a search on it.
Well, that's what Jim's been doing, and
it's work. I'm in the what I was doing was being a little bit behind.
All right.
But it was I would catch up pretty quick.
But the search, but the notes
and help a ton.
Help a ton. We need to get that on there. I don't know why I didn't think to get it out of there and put it into it.
Is it a hard copy?
You know, I've got
I could just go scan all the pages.